Welcome to the Repurpose Your Career podcast, brought to you by Career Pivot. This podcast is where those of us in the second half of life come together to discuss how to repurpose our careers for the 21st century. Come listen to career experts give you proven strategies, listen to people like you tell their stories on how they repurpose their careers, and finally, get your questions answered. Your host, Mark Miller, has made six career pivots over the last 30 years. He understands this is not about jumping out of the frying pan into a fire, but rather to create a plan where you make clear, actionable steps or pivots to a better future career. Are you ready to repurpose your career?
Welcome to episode 36 of the Repurpose Your Career podcast. My name is Mark Miller, and I'll be your host every Monday for a discussion on what it's like to repurpose your career. For any first-time listeners, let me give you a quick overview of the format of the podcast. This podcast is a series. First in the series is an interview with an expert. Last week, I interviewed Richard Eisenberg, managing editor of nextavenue.org. Second in the series is an interview with someone who has repurposed their career. This week, I want to recap eight previous interviews. The third in the series is a topic that I choose. Next week, I'll be reading an excerpt from the audio version of Repurpose Your Career, a practical guide for the second half of life. The fourth in the series is mailbag episode, where I answer your questions. That should give you a good idea of the sequence of episodes, and I encourage you to go back through the archives to find episodes that might inspire you to repurpose your career. Repurpose Your Career, a practical guide for the second half of life, is available on Amazon in both paperback and Kindle ebook formats. The book is also available in advanced distribution around the world, which means you're able to purchase the book on sites like Barnes & Noble and other fine online retailers. As you probably figured out, I've started recording the audio version of this book with a plan to have it available in September. I have interviewed eight individuals who have repurposed their careers. Five of them have pivoted to some form of entrepreneurship, and three have just changed jobs. There have been three common themes that have permeated most of their stories. First, they had an idea to make a change and largely did nothing. Second, there was a moment or event that vaulted them into action, or I like to say, kicked them in the butt. Lastly, no matter how well they planned it, things did not turn out as planned. They needed to adapt as they went along. In this episode, I want to review some of their stories. I am going to be playing clips from their interviews. Let me give you some examples of the moments when they had the idea but did nothing. In episode 3, I interviewed Dr. Joel Dobbs. Dr. Dobbs was an accomplished pharmaceutical executive. Dr. Dobbs now has a portfolio career that includes consulting, teaching, and coaching. He planned this out in a very methodical manner. I wish everyone had the foresight that Dr. Dobbs had to create a great second act. Listen to Dr. Dobbs explain how he got the idea for his second act.
Yeah, there was sort of a series of things that happened. And I would sort of describe it initially as I was probably in my late 40s, maybe 50 years old. And you have one of those experiences probably around a birthday, as I recall, when you sort of wake up one morning and you realize that statistically, I have more yesterdays than I have tomorrows. And you begin to think about, you know, the impact that you're going to leave behind. And it was along about this time, probably around when I was 50, 51 years old, maybe, I read a book that just literally changed the way I thought about my career. The book is written by a guy named Bob Buford. It's called Halftime. And what Bob does is he uses the metaphor of a sporting event, and he talks about in the first half, we focus on success, and we, as he puts it, we run up the score. And at some point, we have something causes us to pause. And in my case, it was really this sort of realization that my, statistically speaking, my life is probably more than half over. And you start having a period of reflection, and there's kind of two paths you can take. There's a destructive path, which we sometimes call a midlife crisis. And in a midlife crisis, we tend to focus not on what we have to offer, but what we feel like we have missed. And what we frequently do is engage in self-destructive behavior. It's usually become, it's all about me. It's all about, you know, what can I get? What have I missed? All those kind of things. And many people have experienced that. And I could, we could spend the rest of the time, I could share horror stories of friends of mine who ruined their lives with these kind of things.
You tell me you didn't buy a Ferrari?
I did not buy a Ferrari. Or trade my wife in on a newer model. But I know people who did. But the other path is sort of the reflective path, the halftime path, where you begin to think more about not what have I missed, but what do I have to offer? And Bob Buford talks about it in terms of significance. And for he describes halftime as a pause. It's like a regrouping where you go through this period of reflection. And what you're really asking is what do I do with what I have been given? How do I give back? How do I turn the second half of my life into one that leverages my success but focuses on significance? And that's kind of what I begin focusing on, is really thinking about what do I want to do next? A good friend of mine uses the analogy. He says for a lot of people, and he says it's particularly true of men more so than women, but that's a generalization. But as he says, they climb the ladder of success and get to the top only to realize that it was leaning against the wrong building. And they discover that it's like, oops, you know, this is not what I thought it was going to be. And I was experiencing some of that. I was very fortunate that I had enjoyed. I'm a country boy from North Alabama. I grew up in the middle of nowhere in a farming country of northeastern Alabama. And so suddenly I'm in a place where I can use the corporate jets. I'm making more money than I ever dreamed imaginable and all of those kind of things. But here's the strange thing. It didn't feel like I thought it would feel. It was just something missing. That's the best way I can describe it. And I think that's why the book Halftime resonated with me so strongly is what he was describing is, like he had been reading my mind, and it was just it resonated with me. And that really sort of catapulted me into thinking about doing something very different.
As you can see, Dr. Dobbs was inspired by Bob Buford's Halftime book. In episode 7, I interviewed Mike O'Krent. Mike had a successful career in the carpeting business, but now has a business called Life Stories Alive, where he chronicles people's life stories on video. Mike was given a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to train to interview Holocaust survivors by Steven Spielberg. So let's listen to Mike tell his story.
Back in 1996, actually in 1995, and a few years before 1995, I was volunteering for the Jewish Federation of San Antonio, teaching about the Holocaust. They have a wonderful program where we go out to the schools and teach the Holocaust. Well, Steven Spielberg is filming Schindler's List in Poland, and survivors are coming up and saying they have a story they want to tell. So in his genius, he realizes that, you know, these survivors aren't going to be around forever. So he starts what was called then the Survivors of the Shoah, which Shoah means Holocaust in Hebrew, the Survivors of the Shoah Visual History Foundation. And he started this with a goal of capturing 50,000 survivor stories worldwide. We ended up capturing 52,000, by the way, in 39 languages all over the world. But when calls started to go into the foundation from Austin and San Antonio, South Texas, the foundation sent a letter to the Jewish Federation of San Antonio saying they need interviewers. If they know of anybody who was going to volunteer their time and expense to fly to Los Angeles to be trained, and I jumped all over it. I loved it. And learned the process of interviewing somebody. I don't have a journalism background. I have a business background. I knew nothing about this.
Well, heck, you were a carpeting guy.
Right. They don't know much, right? I didn't know much. But they taught me how to do this, and I interviewed those survivors from 96 to 2000. And found it to be one of the most fascinating experiences of my life. So they taught me the process, but being the catalyst, the one responsible for sitting across from somebody, and in many cases for the first time in 50 years, they're telling their story. And knowing, as Spielberg said, we have one shot at this. So knowing that that was your shot and you were responsible for the stories coming out, the whole stories coming out, and that was a rush. That was an absolute thrill and a rush, and I loved it. But in 2000, the interviews were over, and I just went about my business in the carpet business after that.
That was an amazing opportunity that Mike was given. In episode 28, I interviewed Jennifer Winter, who in her previous career was head of sports sponsorship for Turner Broadcasting. The problem was she hated sports and really disliked her job. She was frozen because everyone told her she had the greatest job ever. I like to say she drank the Kool-Aid. Listen to Jennifer tell her story.
Well, I was at Turner, and so I had started off in book publishing, and then my boss, I was able to move. She knew somebody in sports, and I knew Turner was changing, and they were were looking to be acquired by and merging with Time Warner, and I knew that the book division was going to go away, and I moved over to sports, and then there somehow through my time there, I had moved up and become the VP of sports sponsorship. And like, it was like, how did this happen? I hated sports. It was like when I met my husband, his family was huge into sports. And it was kind of this thing. Like, I didn't want to talk about sports when I was around them. And then there I was at this job at Turner, traveling and going to big sporting events and being around all these athletes and on-air talent. I hated it. I absolutely hated it. And I had to watch tons of sports television. I used to sit and think like, this was people's dream job, and people told me that every day, literally, that I had the best job ever. I had this dream job. I, you know, was around sports 24/7, and I worked 24/7 on sports. And I, like, how did that happen? I kept thinking, why didn't I move to entertainment at Turner? Like, they had a whole entertainment division, and they had news, which, and CNN and Headline, and somehow all those sort of opportunities never opened up. And here I was in sports, the job that everyone wanted, and I shouldn't say I absolutely hated it. It wasn't for me. I kept thinking, why? This is what people love to do, and here I am in it, and I don't really even want to watch the game that we're broadcasting.
Yeah, but you got to know Charles Barkley.
I did. I got to know all kind of, and I did. I got to meet all kinds of great sports athletes and personalities, and that was great. He's fabulous, but meeting Charles and getting to know him wasn't enough. I mean, it didn't make me, it wasn't a reason to stay, but I stayed forever. I stayed, you know, 21 years at Turner.
Well, I like to say you drank the Kool-Aid.
Yes, I would say I definitely drank the Kool-Aid. I did not see a world outside of Turner when I was there. In Atlanta, there was a couple of big companies, Delta and Coke and Cox Communications, and everyone wanted to be at Turner. That's where you wanted to be. Turner was it in Atlanta for a while for people who wanted to be a part of a big company, big global company.
So what changed? What initiated your journey to want to make a change?
Well, I'll say this. When I was at Turner, I knew that I wasn't happy. I knew that I was working all the time. And I did love the people in there. And I had a lot of great friends, obviously, that I had worked with forever. But I, you know, every day I would come home and I'd be miserable. And I had worked on my resume and I never did anything about it. I'm risk averse. So I kept saying, I'm going to quit. I'm going to leave this. I'm not going to do this anymore. And yet I stayed. So I have to think about it. It was like 2015, Turner and had a new, there was a new head of Turner, and they announced this 2020 program where they were going to be going through and laying off and making the company more lean to focus on a new vision for Turner. They called it the 2020 program. And everyone knew that it was coming, that there were going to be big layoffs. And Turner they'd had layoffs over the years, like Cartoon Network had layoffs and CNN had done layoffs, but they had never done a corporate-wide program where there were going to be layoffs. And I knew about it. I kept thinking, oh, this is my opportunity to make a change.
Now, let's listen to stories about events that vaulted people to act, or like to say, kicked them in the butt. You heard from Mike O'Krent about how he learned to interview Holocaust survivors. It was several years before he took action on creating his business, Life Stories Alive. Let's listen to Mike tell his story on what vaulted him into action.
What happened that allowed you to make the pivot?
Through my wife, I found a good business coach. And I sat across from him like I'm sitting across from you right now, Mark. And I said, I've known people in my lifetime that are passionate about their work. How can I find my passion? I don't know what I'm going to do, but I want to do something I care about. He said, okay. He had me go through an exercise. Want to know the exercise?
Yes. Okay. We got the exercise.
He said, make a list between now and next week, the next time we meet, of the things that you've done that have to fall into these two categories. You have to have liked doing it and you thought you were good at it, right? If you thought you were good at selling carpet but hated it, don't put it on the list, right? So, okay, so I make a list. The next week I sit across from him and he said, read each one slowly. Okay, being a father, being a husband, I thought I was good at it, I liked doing that, you know, and I made a list of about 20, 25 things. Finished reading the list and I looked at him and I said, okay. He said, and he was making notes. He said, reread this, this, and this. So I reread those three things. And I looked at him and I said, what's up? What are you doing? He says, when you say interviewing Holocaust survivors for Steven Spielberg, you light up. Why? And he flipped the switch and I went on and on about how much I just absolutely loved that. And he let me finish, which was smart. He was a good listener. And when I finished, he looked at me and says, can you make a business out of doing something like that? And bam, the light bulb went off. And I thought, oh my God, I've got a process that I've learned. I could bootstrap it. I could do it out of my house. I know in Austin, Texas, where we are right now, there's many talented videographers and editors that I could quote unquote hire on a 1099 and subcontracting basis. And I started. Not knowing if I was going to make any money, not knowing what the market was, not knowing who the competition was, knowing nothing. I said, what the hell? Why not? It's something that I love doing. We'll see. You know, give it a while. If it doesn't work, you know, always go to work somewhere else, you know?
In episode 32, we heard from Kay McManus, who has a business called Kay Can. Kay was a business development professional working for technology companies before she was laid off in 2009. Listen to Kay's story on what got her moving to create her business.
I moved into the world of technology, and I first started working in business development marketing, if you will, because that was my focus in college. Then I moved on to sales, having that gift for gab, and finally made it to account management, where you do a little bit of everything. You market the product, you sell the product, and then you manage it with your appointed customers or clients.
And who are you working for during this time?
During this time, I worked with Future, and I worked with AMD, and the last employer in that technology arena was Spansion.
Yeah, and Spansion was part of AMD, and they were kind of spun out. If I remember, they were, a certain type of memory.
Yes, indeed. And other little widgets and gadgets that they manufactured. And unfortunately for Spansion, they overextended themselves financially. And middle part of 2009, they decided that they needed to pull back from one of the facilities that they were setting up in Kuala Lumpur and realized that they didn't have finances to cover various things. And they started methodically dismissing individuals, including middle management and account managers. So that's one of the reasons I was propelled into managing or coming up with the idea of KCAN Incorporated. It was not only that being laid off by Spansion, but also realizing a little bit before that most of my life as an account manager was spent in this cubicle in front of the computer, and being the kind of gregarious people person that I am, that got old really fast. And then if anybody has been in sales and management where manufacturing and supplies are concerned, you finally realize that if somebody that has failed to plan or lack of planning on somebody else's part actually ends up being your problem. So those three factors were the reason, you know, finally just went, okay, gonna do something else. Don't know what it is, but I'm out here.
You were the only one laid off, right? This is 2009.
Among thousands, yes. The only among thousands.
So they laid you off, and what happened next?
Well, the next thing that happened, the persons that were remaining in Spansion were basically overloaded. I mean, and I think that was a complaint for a lot of individuals that still have a job. They had a job of two or three people. And what had happened was some of the managers that I had worked with had realized that they didn't know how to do a different job, or they didn't know how to support themselves. And those managers started calling me. And one manager would say to the other, well, how did you get that done? I thought you didn't know how to do that. And they thought, well, I called Kay McManus. Kay can do it. And so after several months of doing that as a freelancer, if you will, I just decided, well, I can do this, I can organize, I can bookkeeping, and I can be an account representative at trade shows or expos. So I just came up with K-Can Incorporated.
Now I want you to listen to Vicki McCullough of Sequitur Marketing. In episode 11, Vicki told us her story of being laid off multiple times and finally going, enough is enough. And she started Sequitur Marketing. Listen to her story and what got her going. What finally, as we say, kicked you in the butt to go to start Sequitur Marketing?
That last layoff was just a little harder on me than the previous ones had been. I did have a good team to work with there, but overall the job itself had had some challenges and not been as satisfying. And when I left, I recalled what I felt was a good match for me being in the corporate world. And I started out diligently looking for that new place to land. And it was not happening. The search, it didn't feel the same. It didn't feel productive. It got to meet lots of great new people and learn about companies and all the things I'd done before, but I was not settling in. And so as I had done during other layoffs, I was picking up contract work and thinking about that. And at some point in those few months, I just told myself, this is the time, just jump. It had been in my mind for a while, but you know, yeah, I got that push in my own mind. I got that push to go do it.
In the last segment, let's listen to some stories on how things did not exactly turn out the way they planned. Two of these are people who made multiple career pivots, or I like to say multi-step pivots. The other is Tom Singer, who is a professional speaker now. So let's start out with, in episode 20, we heard from Elizabeth Rebe. Well, you may have heard Elizabeth on this podcast. Elizabeth helps me with the mailbag sessions, and she and I have been working together for multiple years. Elizabeth worked for an environmental engineering company for over 20 years, working on air and water permitting. From that point on, she took a multi-step pivot to get where she is today as a marketing professional for an international mining and equipment company. Listen to Elizabeth's story on how she navigated multiple pivots to get where she is today.
At the engineering firm and a former coworker of mine, I met her at a networking event and we started talking, and I told her that I was interested in making a change and doing something different. And so she told me she had a project manager position available at her firm. So I applied and was able to, you know, get hired and go work for her firm. That company, I went from about 15, 18 people to 250 people. And that company primarily we worked all over the country. And they had multiple offices. They had, so very spread out, not so centrally located like my old company was. So I went to work for her, and it was a good experience because it taught me, number one, how a bigger company operates and their business model and how they were aggressive in going after companies and clients and how they were, you know, creating their message and their brand. And one of the biggest pieces of that company was their marketing department. And the lady who ran that, her name was Ramona, was very outgoing and was very aggressive in terms of making sure the engineers and project managers knew that she was the marketing person, that she would help them with the branding, with the message, and help people reach out and you know, connect with future clients, gave them ideas of what to do and things. So, and she was producing really interesting content and, you know, swag to give away to clients and things like that. So,
and I have some of that swag.
You do. I gave it away. I was doing my job. You know, it was really an eye-opening experience, because at my previous firm, they relied a lot on word of mouth, which is great. And as a small firm, that worked really well, because, you know, they could, you know, a person could call them and next thing we knew, we had a job. Where this, the bigger firm, you were always out looking and having to find that next opportunity. So I spent a year at that firm and learned a lot about their marketing and how important that was, as well as project management and working for a bigger company. And what does that entail? You may be working with somebody that's in another state and on projects, and how do you manage that? And how do you get, you know, a cohesive product together and make sure it's answering all the questions that you're trying to respond to? So
you learned about marketing, but only because you went out and you pursued Ramona.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Right? It wasn't part of your job, and you kind of figured out, wow, I think I might want to do that.
Yeah, right? I did. I spent a lot of time lurking around her office trying to see what she was doing.
So what happened next?
I stayed there for a year, and then my old company called me up and they said, we want to do some marketing. And I said, well, that's what I'm really interested in doing. And I feel like I could take some marketing, you know, marketing skills and tie them with the technical skills. I could be an advocate for your company, because I could bring together those two things. And I went back to my company that I worked for 20 some years and served as their marketing coordinator for 3 years. So the marketing and was the primary thing, but I also worked on a lot of going after state and federal contracts, because they wanted to take advantage of that, of those programs, because we were a women-owned business. So that was, in addition to doing the marketing, I also worked a lot to develop contacts and set up that program too. And I also worked to try to bring the company in terms of social media and LinkedIn, and got them a new web page and such. So it was 3 years of working very hard to try to set up programs that they could expand upon and use. So
I'll tell you, bluntly, it was a painful experience at times, because she was dealing with engineers doing marketing. Now, by the way, she worked with Vicky McCullough, and Vicky works exclusively with service providers like engineers and architects and lawyers.
Yes, marketing with engineers or any service company is difficult, because it's not an impulse buy. So just to try to encourage the engineers that this was a process. It was a constant tapping at a future client, tapping the shoulder of a future client to help them, you know, to make a decision to buy our services. So that education process was a little bit difficult. The whole education process of marketing, and it just proved to be a little bit overwhelming, just to try to change their mindset and such, and to embrace social media and realize that that could be a great tool for not only a service industry, but for any industry. It's just, you have to employ it and nurture it and keep it going. It's not a one-time deal. So, but it was a good process. It, you know, it helped me learn how to navigate, negotiate and focus on, you know, the end result. And I, you know, along the way, I learned a lot of great social media skills, just marketing skills, just by trial and error and getting to do different things.
Yeah, there's no question that you learned a lot. Mm-hmm. As much as it was painful, you learned a lot. So what happened next?
So towards the end of 2016, I was looking online at a job board, and I found a marketing coordinator position for a company. And so I went to their page, their company page, and found the exact same job, and I applied. And this company is an international company, and they sell products, goods, and services and equipment for the mining industry and the oil and gas industry and the power generation industry. So because of my environmental engineering background, I was very familiar with some of the equipment that they sold and the services that they would provide. So I was able to use that information as well as demonstrate the marketing skills that I had learned and send it off to the company. And it happened very fast, which I know is very unusual. I applied, I think, the second Sunday of November, and by the 1st of December, I had a job offer in hand. And I'm able to work from home, which I really enjoy doing. I work for an international company and will have opportunities to travel not only in the United States, but elsewhere in the world. I get to do content development. I get to do social media, as well as the other marketing support activities, brochure development, and things like that. So it was a sidestep into a neighboring industry from where I was, but it's a great opportunity because I like the possibilities that are potentially in front of me in terms of creativity and working with interesting people and such. It took about 5 years to make this long journey, but which I didn't expect. Now looking back, it was probably right on schedule, just because you have to develop the skills. I didn't have any marketing skills, so I had to go from, basically 0 to 100 and learn as much as I could and as fast as I can. So,
in episode 15. Dean, we heard from Tom Singer. Tom was a business development professional who worked for a law firm until April 1st of 2009. At the bottom of the recession, he was laid off. Tom then launched his career as a full-time keynote speaker and master of ceremonies. Tom had already been speaking as a side career, but the layoff kicked him into gear to make this his full-time profession. Listen to Tom tell you how things did not quite turn out as planned.
So because of my background doing training for law firms, which was where a lot of that side business had come from, after I left the law firm and went to work for a bank and then a consulting firm, I was free to go and do training for law firms because it wasn't competitive to who my employer was. Plus, it got us in front, got my employer sort of pseudo-ly in front of a lot of law firms. So I was able to speak at partner retreats and other stuff. So when I started this business, my thought was 50% of my business will be training in law firms and teaching them how to sell and do business development and market. And the other half will be sort of this association market. Well, in the recession, the law firms didn't just tighten their belt, they turned off the spigot, and they were doing no staff development whatsoever. There was no business for me within the area that I thought was going to be 50% of my training. So I had to focus on the association market, and associations continued to have their meetings. And so my business went from what I thought was going to be half law firm training, half association speaking, to almost entirely sort of that conference, association conference market as my clientele. So that was different. The other thing was, based on what I thought I could earn and what sort of the going rates were for people who weren't famous but were decent at the job, I figured out like how many speeches I would need to get, and I would be able to earn a certain amount of money within sort of a 2-year window. Well, because of the uncertainty of the economy and everything else, I wasn't able to get those rates per speech. It also was a lot harder to get the clients. Although I was able to get plenty, it was harder to get them than I thought. And so it took me closer to 3.5 years to get my income level back up to what I was making in corporate America. But at the meantime, my mortgage didn't change. And, the expenses of raising children didn't go away. And so I hemorrhaged cash as a family. And we tightened our belt, but I mean, you can only tighten it so far. And so we actually used credit cards and went through some cash that we had in reserves and actually spent a lot more money than I expected us to, like by over 100%. Which meant that once my income returned to the area I was used to, it took me another three and a half years to pay off the debt. And so it really, I thought, a couple years, I'll be back on my feet, you know, if I do this. And it took me closer to 6.5 years to really see sort of financial stability again. And even then, you know, I get nervous. I can have a bad quarter and I think, oh my gosh, it's all over. And, you know, then the next quarter's fine. But, I thought by I'm now 8 years into it, I thought it was going to be sort of smooth sailing. And while it's not choppy waters, it's not always as smooth as I maybe expected it would be.
The last in this segment, I would like you to hear Mike Martin's story. Mike's story is real interesting. In episode 24, Mike told us his story on how he spent most of his career in industrial sales. But that career had completely sputtered out. Listen to Mike's story about he went from teaching school to driving trains to finally being a drone pilot instructor. So listen to Mike's story very intently.
I'd say the first pivot came was I was looking at something you'd written called a moment of clarity.
Yes.
Yeah, it was a moment of clarity I had doing a few sales gigs after the big electrical one that starting to sort of cave in on me. And I really discovered it when I did some volunteer work for a program called Science Olympiad at one of the local schools. I had an extensive training in meteorology, you know, being a pilot and that. So I took that and taught the kids how to do the work, the weather problems that the different competitions were handing out to them. They had to do tests and exams, and they were you know, in need of that at the school at the time. I stuck with that for 5 years until the money got cut off for that. That was a shame. But, you know, doing that, working with the kids, I discovered that I kind of had a knack to teach and instruct and get results. So I started substitute teaching and decided going back to school would be a good thing, too. So I thought, I could get my bachelor's degree in teaching. So I set out to do that and went the alternative certification course through a private company. And just as that happened, it was when the big teacher layoff in the state of Texas occurred. And I was already, I went through all the training and I went out to the interview, and it looked like the whole world emptied out in the parking lots of these schools when they had their open houses. So there was a lot of competition and a lot of ex-teachers out there. And I really got the feeling they didn't want a guy like me.
You decided not to go into teaching. So what did you do? If I remember correctly, you went back and got your bachelor's degree, what, in aviation?
You know, I finished the teacher certification, but I was still, you know, trying to get the bachelor's degree. And I thought, what's the quickest way to get one? And I thought, take that aviation, that old AS degree that you got back way back when, and go back into flying, which I did. I found an aviation course up in Killeen in a 4-year school. And lo and behold, I got the bachelor's degree in 2009. And well, here I am now with an aviation bachelor's degree, and I'm an old guy. And, you know, I'm not going to go to the regional airlines. I still didn't have enough flight training to do that yet. I still had to get some more ratings and stuff, and it gets expensive. So I kind of sat there and pondered what I was going to do. I took a job at an airport and at an FBO. That's a fixed base operator. The work there was not very much pay, and it was exciting to be around the planes. And I was a little bit more educated than most of the people there. And I didn't find it very friendly either. So I left that.
And you ended up where?
What could a pilot do who really didn't want to go into the regional airlines? And I started looking at other modes of transportation. You know, thinking wings, wheels, and keels. Maybe I could be a boat captain out in the Gulf of Mexico. Who knows? But I found an opening for train operators in Houston, Texas. And I went down there, not really expecting to be hired. And I passed their test, and they called me back for an interview. Well, I aced the interview really well. About 2 weeks later, I get a letter that I'm going to start train operating school. I didn't expect to pass that interview, but I did a very good job. I guess I'm going to be a train operator. And I looked at my wife, and she looked at me and said, "You're going to move to Houston and drive trains?" I said, "I'd like to do that, but I know that's impossible." And you know what she said? She said, "Go right ahead." I went to Houston, looked around at the apartment situation and said, nope. And I bought a used RV trailer and I put it in a really swanky RV resort 6 minutes from where I was going to operate the trains. Then came train operator school, 10 weeks of intense training on the rails, the rules of the road, signals. After 10 weeks, I got my certificate and I was out washing trains because the routes were only for the guys that had a little tenure there. But it wouldn't take long, they said. Maybe a year and you'll have a regular route. So I found a part called IT, which is integrated testing. And what you do there is you take a train when it's delivered, and we were getting brand new trains almost weekly, and you burn it in, just like a server system or whatever. Because after all, these new LRVs are highly automated, sophisticated rolling computers, if you will. And you drive them up and down the tracks at the wee hours of the morning, try and break them, try and make the systems fail. And we did a lot, and we got improvements on the trains. And after about 500 miles of no problems, that train was commissioned. And I burnt in a lot of trains. And then eventually, I got the opportunity to help the crews that were building out the new rail routes. And so I would run a test train up and down, and I would pit the train against the signal systems, the traffic signal systems, see if we could make those things fail. And we were out there on those rail lines before they opened up many, many hours trying to get those things fine-tuned and ready to go for the public. And finally, the big day came, and I got to run the first PR train, you know, all the city officials, and I took them all the way down from one end to the other and then back. And that was really exciting. It's kind of like the culmination of everything I got to do with Houston Rail. And it was kind of like an affirmation that, hey, we love the work you did. Why don't you go ahead and take these special people down? It was kind of a nice little reward at the end. But, you know, after that was all said and done, the rail lines were open. There was nothing else going on. And I felt like it was time to return home to Austin and my lovely wife, and thank her for the 2 years I got to spend out there and learn a whole lot of things. The thing it did most, it gave me a great deal of confidence. And also, I got to train new rail operators and some of the old operators on the new lines in the city and basically stand behind them for a couple of trips and then sign them off, just like a flight instructor or a Czech airman would sign off a new airline pilot. So I was kind of getting a little satisfaction out of that. And then when I returned home to Austin, I looked around a little bit and I discovered that there was quite a bit of activity in the drone world, which I am now.
When you started looking around for flying drones, was there any barriers for you to be able to train people on drones or fly drones yourself?
Well, the first one was you need to have about 25 to 50 hours on something sophisticated, like they call them prosumer products. That's where you take it right out of the box. It's a very sophisticated piece of equipment. It's not a toy. When I first talked to a few companies that were doing aerial inspection, they said, you probably need to get a DJI Phantom drone and not that little toy. I start out with a little toy drone. In fact, I'm looking at it right now. It's sitting on the shelf. I haven't flown it since I got the job with the DART drones. But that little $50 drone got the whole thing going for me. And then I went out and purchased a Phantom drone, Phantom product, DJI product, and got the 25 hours in. And I went back to that company a few months later, and they were really, really trying to influence me to get on board with them. And after I looked at, you know, what they have to do being deployed in the field for 3 weeks in a trailer, and thought, you know, that's not exactly what I want to do. That's something maybe a younger guy would want to do, but you know, I kind of like being around home. And then I found this DART drones. I kept seeing ads popping up all over because, you know, I've been Googling drones, and they DART drones, come and train with us. We're the leading company in the United States. So I found an Indeed job alert one time for DART drones, and I called the number on the thing and found a little bit more about DART drones, and I applied for the job, and then I got Skype interviewed 3 times. Never had an interview like that. But when I finally met the CEO, Abby, I sold her with my Science Olympiad experience and how much I liked training young people, especially the girls. I really like to see the girls get into the technology, and she really liked that. I figure she would, because she's quite an entrepreneur, and she went to a school and trained with other people. And it was mostly a man's world, but she's a big fan for girl power too. And I think that really was the key that where we clicked.
Mike could not have planned his career trajectory. He made corrections as he went along. All the while, he learned a lot about himself. I want to close out this podcast with a closing statement from Mike Martin.
First and foremost, even if it seems a little wacky or crazy and it seems like a dream, never give up. Try it out. Look at it. There may be one avenue might be not your thing, but you might find another avenue, like the training part of Dart Drones. The first few jobs I looked at were not quite for me, but just keep looking at the industry. I think what we call we work the industry deep and then we work it wide.
I know that was a bit of a long episode, but I encourage you to go back and listen to the episodes of the interviews that resonated with you. Please pick up a copy of Repurpose Your Career, A Practical Guide for the Second Half of Life at Amazon.com or any of the other fine online retailers. When you complete the book, I would very much appreciate if you would write an honest review on Amazon.com. By the way, I am starting work on the audio version of the book in the coming month. Lastly, I am working on the Career Pivot community website. This will be a membership area of the current CareerPivot.com website, and I have an initial cohort of members helping me develop the content. Look for more on this in the coming months. Thank you for listening all the way to the end of the Repurpose Your Career podcast. You will find all the show notes at careerpivot.com/episode-36. Please hop over to careerpivot.com and subscribe to get updates on this podcast and all the other happenings at Career Pivot. I publish a blog post with show notes every Tuesday morning. If you subscribe to the Career Pivot blog, you will receive the Career Pivot Insights email every Sunday, which includes a link to this podcast. You can also subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play. Please take a moment and go leave a review. If you're not sure how to leave an iTunes review, please go to careerpivot.com/review. Hope to see you next Monday for another episode of Repurpose Your Career podcast.